I'm delighted to be here tonight in the cozy confines of Artifact Coffee to continue our Origin Speaker Series. I'm Spike Jurta, the owner of Woodbury Kitchen here in Baltimore. This gathering is intended to advance the conversation about food, its origins, and what is happening around our food system in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. We started our first restaurant, Woodbury Kitchen, with a commitment to local sourcing, and now work closely with more than 60 different farmers and producers throughout the region. We supply our four restaurants and our canning and butchery operations with meat, eggs, grains, fish and shellfish, cooking oil, cheeses and produce, literally everything we need to feed our guests. The hope is that this series will shine a light on the work that this community is doing in our area. The conversation is held monthly at Artifact, our coffee shop, in the heart of the Woodbury neighborhood in Baltimore.
Welcome, everybody, to Origins. This is our I think it's our 18th or 19th, I can't keep track anymore, Origins. And tonight we're going to be talking about all things fermented, pickled, and canned. So I can see this brought a lot of you out tonight, so thanks for coming out. I'm Dana Slater. For those of you that don't know me, I'm the producer of Origins. And I'll just quickly introduce the panel, and then we'll get into their bios a little bit, and then I just want to acknowledge all the people that go into making this thing happen. So let's see. To my left is Shane Carpenter and Megan Carpenter from Hex Ferments. And to Megan's left is Lauren Sandler, who is the Director of Preservation for the Canning Shed, which is the whole canning operation for all of the Woodbury Kitchen and sister restaurants. And then Spike Jurta to the left of Lauren, and to the left of Spike we have Sheila and Sarah from Gordy's Pickles, based in D.C. So welcome to all of you guys. Thanks for coming. So I just always like to find a few little things about the subject that we were talking about, and I found this quote that I thought was an apt way to start the evening. Fermentation may have been a better invention than fire. And that was said by David Foster Wallace. So that was pretty appropriate, right? And then on the way here tonight, I was actually listening to NPR, and there was a thing on the former canneries in Carroll County, and evidently Carroll County used to have 58 canneries at one time. I don't know, I think there are probably none now, but it was evidently a very, very large industry, and then obviously the railroads took over after that. So in 2007, in October 2007, Woodbury Kitchen opened. So we're about to come on the 10th year anniversary of Woodbury Kitchen. And so the whole idea of local sourcing obviously was the primary tenet of the restaurant. And then came January, and I think Spike looked around at his staff and said, what do we have that's local, that's growing? And so not a whole lot. So that's when the whole sort of notion of canning and preserving and pickling and all of that sort of started to take hold. And then before you knew it, there's a whole division now that Lauren runs, that runs all the canning. I think at one point they were doing it, Spike, correct me if I'm wrong, you were doing it in some of the homes around Woodbury Kitchen?
What the? I don't know if I want to admit to that, but there was some activity. There was more about some storage. Things were being stored in some of the apartments nearby. Right. Okay. That was a long time ago, and
you graduated.
We did, big time.
So just wanted to thank a lot of people that made the Origins happen. The proceedings tonight, for those of you that are new, this is all recorded and uploaded as a podcast to Heritage Radio, which is based in Brooklyn, New York. You can find all the past Origins podcasts on there. So we'll talk for about an hour and 15 minutes, and then we'll take it and edit it and upload it to the station. So check it out. They're a great station. It's all about food, everything you ever want to know about food. So if you don't know about it, check it out. Thanks, Spike, again, for hosting us for all of these Origins. Hannah Reagan, who's standing at the curtain, who's a miraculous board mayor behind the scenes. Hey, Hannah. And Lauren Payman, who's running around in the kitchen probably, and her staff, Patrick and Grace, who are always here to help us every with all these origins. At the end of this, we sort of turn this into a little restaurant, so it's a little bit of a maddening thing when we do that, so bear with us. We have Opie, and I think his name is Dr. Dre, in the kitchen. Is that right?
That is not right. But we have a couple ringers. We have some of the chefs that are going to be working with us in D.C. are here tonight to cook. Matt and Andre.
Okay.
Yeah. I guess in some parallel universe he probably is.
All right. Mary Romeo is right here. She does our Facebook page. It's Origins, a speaker series. If you'd like to follow us, and Donnie Carlo is back behind the curtain. He's our recording engineer. And Sean O'Shea does all our flowers, so thanks to all of them. And I think without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Spike, who's going to do a little introduction. We're going to little tag team this. I think you go for the first two, and then I'll go for the other one.
All right, so thanks, Dana. Thank you all for being here. It's great that we're all kind of cozy in here as a storm rages outside in the friendly confines of Artifact Coffee. I'm so happy to be joined by some of my favorite people, some really great people who happen to be making some of the most delicious food in our neck of the woods. First, Sarah Gordon and Sheila Fain of Gordy's Pickle Jar. So happy you guys could make it up from D.C.
Thanks for having us.
We love your pickles. We serve them here and at Parts and Labor. We have them on the shelf there, and we're very proud to have Gordy's Pickles here in Baltimore. And love what you guys have done for so long, so thanks for being here. On the other side, Lauren Sandler, as Dana said, our Director of Preservation. I just thought it was so cool that we have a Director of Preservation that's not about buildings. It's like And she does incredible work, again, starting kind of where we this realization that we had at Woodbury that we needed to start preserving. And Lauren is kind of a polymath when it comes to preservation. We do some pickling, but a lot of what she does is more around jams and tomatoes and also other methods of preservation that are important to us, including freezing and drying. So we might stick more to the pickling side of things, but she does tremendous range of work there for us at Canning Shed.
Okay, Megan and Shane of Hex Ferments. See, Megan comes from Minneapolis originally. Is that fair? I think Shane comes by way of South Dakota. So how they found Baltimore, I'm not really sure yet. But they both grew up with gardens and were around kitchens most of their lives and kind of did some simple kimchi and sauerkraut in their younger days. And then I think Megan had some digestive issues, possibly.
Or? Good call from overdrinking in college. Good call from too many bags of Cheetos. Yeah.
There you go. So from there we get experiments.
Cheetos and bags.
I think they went to, was it Ireland that you went to Ireland to learn how to do some of the?
No. Okay. I studied art there in Ireland, okay. And had my first experience with drinking kombucha tea.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, Hex was founded in 2014, and it's based in Belvedere Square here in Baltimore. And they make kombucha, sauerkraut, kimchi, beet pickles, and five different kinds of kraut. So
much more than that, actually.
And more than that. Okay.
I don't think this was
turn
on.
Back over to Spike.
Cool. Great. Well. Again, this is clearly a popular topic given the turnout that we have here and tonight. And I kind of wanted to start because I tend to skip over things and get right into the more, I don't know, and just talk about pickles for a second. And I'm really excited because we have, I think, two of the best representatives of I think, maybe what you consider the two main ways to make a pickle. Mm-hmm. And if I got this right, which is kind of brined.
Yeah.
And fermented.
Yep.
So maybe you could talk, maybe start on the brine side and talk about what a brine pickle, what are the pickles that you make, how do you do it, what is a pickle anyway?
Well, I mean, the brine in a loose sense, we both can relate to, it's just a spectrum. In fermenting, you're having a solution that has high salinity, so we share that bond, we both use water and salt, and for us, we're producing acidified pickles, which require the addition of heat and a lowered pH. And we, so in that sense, we also have vinegar in our brines to start the process.
So lower pH, something we've been wrapping our heads around for a while, but lower pH equals more sour, more acid, right?
Yes.
And this all goes to kind of the safety and the fact that you guys make pickles that are shelf stable, I think mostly, right? In jars that can sit.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
So is there a magic number, or what do you got? Is there a pH that you have to hit to?
Yes. All of the vegetables that we can are low.
Would you mind yelling at us?
Yeah, I'll
She sure does yell at me. So.
All of the vegetables that we can are considered low acid foods. And for us to reach our equilibrium, we need to be below 4.5 to have a safe, shelf-stable product for consumers.
And what do you guys make? What are the big Gordy's pickle jar?
We make a variety of bread and butters called sweet chips, a dill variety called hot chili spears. We also do a Cajun okra, a relish, some other condiments like a cherry pepper spread, and we've kind of
we do a Bloody Mary mix. We've gotten into beverage, so now we do a Bloody Mary mix and a fine brine, which is just kind of our hot chili spear brine filtered out and put in a can. And we love beverage.
Well, I want to talk to you guys about that brine because it like kind of changed my worldview when I first saw it. But first, I want to talk to Megan and Shane a little bit about the fermented side of the pickle world and what that is and how it happens. And I think it's something that's, you know, a lot of people are interested in these days. And
First off, just want to thank Dana and Woodbury and Artifact for hosting. This is our first Origins as any of this, so it's really cool to be here. So thank you. Can everybody hear me?
Is this thing on?
No, it's only for recording.
Oh, okay.
Oh, sorry, recording.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're Hex Ferments. We're based here in Baltimore. We use fermentation as our primary pickling process. So we make a variety of pickled things using lactic acid fermentation. So we don't use vinegar or heat at all. We just use high quality unrefined sea salt, filtered water, vegetables, and microbes and thyme. Just a little background on what is lactic acid fermentation or lactofermentation. It's true fermentation. So it's the first form of food preservation that utilizes no fire, except for the fire of fermentation itself, created by microbes. So we take vegetables, locally grown produce like cabbage and carrots and onions, shred them fine or into a specific cut, and mix that with Celtic sea salt, and it creates its own brine, and it starts creating up the acidic environment, which vinegar kind of helps already establish. And within 3 days, you have beautiful sauerkraut or a pickle. That's our process in a nutshell. So we make everything from plain sauerkraut to cucumber pickles to daikon pickles to beet pickles to kimchi
And worth mentioning that oftentimes pickle is what people imagine is a cucumber, but pickling refers to the whole process of preservation, including, you know, all sorts of different vegetables, but using a, you know, either a canning process or a fermentation process. One of the key distinction, I suppose, is that with the process of fermentation, what results is a probiotic rich, you know, microbial environment that is a byproduct of all of that invisibilia that is on all of the vegetables and all of the plants, all terrestrial plants around us. So you're essentially just creating an environment that favors a specific outcome. So anything that you control to create that specific outcome is pickled in a way. And how you differentiate can be whether it's been, you know, it's gone through a brining process with a hot water or a heat component, which preserves it and makes it shelf stable, or without heat or vinegar that allows it to be, it continues to be alive, but is not shelf stable. It needs to be either refrigerated or it's sour in its end state and progressively sour if you continue to let the environment acidify. And for some people, it, like, you know, there's sour pickles, there's half sours, you know, cucumber pickles, you know, so half sour is like interrupting it at a certain shorter pH. You know, if you're going to go full sour, you just let the pickles go, the cucumber pickles go, or whatever vegetable you're fermenting. A lot of people know half or full sours as cucumbers. But
so full sours are just, that's a fermented pickle, right?
Yep.
A fermented cucumber.
Cucumber. But it's a, yeah, it's a fermented cucumber, yeah. that's a but it's a fermented product.
Yes.
Yep.
And along
yep.
with sour, I mean, the stuff that we know that most people are familiar with, full sours, sauerkraut, kimchi, right? All fermented.
All fermented.
All fermented, yeah. A lot of times what we, you know, we have a shop in Belvedere Square and we're at farmers markets, and so often it's differentiating, you know, like, yeah, it's a pickle, but how is it different? Well, primarily it is that we don't use heat or vinegar. So it's a process that's been around for thousands of years, and it's how people have eaten through times of abundance and scarcity all over the planet for thousands of years, whether they're burying it in, you know, caves or pots or in earthenware or whatever the vessel might have been. It was just, you know, like, here comes a whole lot of produce and I know it's going to get cold as hell. Like, let's just stuff it all in, like, have Thor try it, you know, in December. If it works out, you know, like, all the better.
Mm-hmm. But that's the beauty of salt, yeah. though, and that's truly when it comes to our, you know, our business at heart, it's salt. And if we mm-hmm. didn't have salt, we wouldn't have fermentation. And so I think, you know, when you look back to just preservation, whether it be, you know, making vinegar or whether it be making beer or wine, it's that catalyst that first jumpstarts that thing, whether it's honey or salt. We realize salt helps cure things and preserve things.
Right.
And keep meats maybe fresher a little bit.
And you, Shane, you mentioned the outcome. This is an outcome that is so certain. I mean, if this fermentation takes place, it is one of the safest foods. I mean, one of the ways to make one of the... It's utterly safe.
Yes.
I mean, I remember Sandra Katz saying once, yep. like, there's never been a single instance of foodborne illness from a lacto-fermented vegetable.
Yeah, it's amazing. You
I mean,
know,
documented
then,
it, yeah.
Yep.
You know, one might suppose that there are some larger systems at play to make such a complementary food source for humans available in that cycle, you
uh-huh.
know, through scarcity and abundance.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's worth mentioning, I think David Foster Wallace was talking about booze, but we'll take his apple, you know.
But booze is fermentation.
Yeah.
Distilled.
So, a different outcome, but when we appreciate,
but related, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, as we sip kombucha cocktails. Yeah.
So Sarah and Sheila, 6 years ago, is it?
Yeah.
For Gordy's
Almost
Pickle Jar.
About, yeah.
And I'm so interested in what you two were thinking when you're like, all right, we're gonna start a pickle company.
We're still wondering.
Yeah.
We just both really love food. We really love pickles. We really loved preserving things. And Sheila's an amazing cook, amazing at, I don't know, really anything she does in the kitchen, and my background's in branding and communications, and we just really wanted to work together, so just started making sweet chips, and then our friend asked us to do her wedding favors, and we were like, oh, sure, it'll be like our first time for people to, like, try them out in the world, and so we did wedding favors for, like, 200 people, and we didn't think that we'd get feedback right away, but at the wedding, like, everyone just shoved their fork in the jar, and
we're like, oh, your sweet chips are amazing. Like, how, you know, and we're like, whoa, what did we get ourselves into here? And then ever since then, it kind of just took off.
And we were sitting out front, and one of our Artifact regulars was talking about pickles,
right.
and it just reminded me of what a competitive, you know, and we're just learning this kind of recently, is like how competitive shelf space in supermarkets and markets are, and what a competitive part of the food system you guys have entered into. And but your pickles are so damn good, I can't believe that anybody really stands a chance. What? How do you make your pickles taste so good?
Without giving away. We want you to continue to buy it from us, Mike, so we're not going to tell
but
you.
But I think it's really hard. It's one of those things, very simple, and you've only got a couple things. You've got acidity, you've got salt,
right.
You've got the vegetable itself. In your case, a lot of times cucumbers, sometimes okra. But they are just so dialed. And I guess, you know, as somebody that thinks a lot about food, it's just something that when I taste your pickles, I always think, whatever it is, this is a really good pickle. And it's just... A
lot of love. But, a lot of love.
Is there anything else you can share with me?
I mean, I will say that you have to let whatever medium you're working with work to your advantage, and you keep it simple. And the more simplistic it is, oftentimes the better product you will have. Mm-hmm. And we really pay attention, very close attention, to all of the details that's going to make that specific pickle and that format shine. So we, especially with something like a sweet chip, go the extra steps to make the best possible bread and butter possible.
Yeah, I would say. Is this the same sweet chip that you gave out at that wedding? All those things?
Yeah.
Is it really?
Yeah.
You
still make it the same exact way, which
that's
is crazy.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Whose recipe is that? Is that a family recipe?
No.
Just something like you guys.
Yeah. Just Sheila churning it out, and she'd give me samples, and I'd be like, no, that was not gonna work. Back to the drawing board. So it was a lot of different variations.
A lot of iterations. Mm-hmm. And.
Cool. But when you get it, you're just like,
yeah.
I got it.
Yeah. It's a great feeling. I'm sure you guys get that a lot. All right.
Yeah, we're fortunate.
Lauren Sandler is here, and. You do a little bit of all of this, right? And I don't want to leave out, I don't know, is this a prop? Why is this here? It's just always here. And you're also making snake oil. And so Lauren is out in Elkridge. We've gone, as Dana mentioned, we started preserving and canning at Woodbury, you know, pretty much the first winter. The rest of that story is that we bought 10 cases of red peppers and 10 cases of tomatoes from Joan and Drew Norman at One Straw Farm, and we froze them all because we had literally no idea what we were doing. So we froze them in bags, and then like 6 weeks later is when we had that moment. It's like, what do we do now? We had cooked all of Joan and Drew's peppers and tomatoes, which weren't that great anyway, because frozen tomatoes, just for the record, is not... we're not freezing any tomatoes.
No.
All right. We learned that too. And then we also learned, you know, along the way a lot about preservation. And finally, Lauren joined us almost 3 years ago now, or?
Two and a half
years ago. And you're out in Elkridge. We've got this incredible little canning kitchen. Why don't you talk a little bit about what you do, and especially the pickle side of it, which I think we would include this in that conversation, right? As a fermented...
Yeah, snake oil is a fermented product, but we do kill the fermentation process with vinegar and water in the end.
And heat.
And heat. Heat is a big component of pretty much everything we do when it comes to food in jars. Canning Shed's a state-approved food processing facilities, and we make jams and jellies and hot sauces, but we also do dried food, like Spike said, frozen food. We juice food. We have an HPP machine in our facilities, so we utilize that. And we pretty much chase the season. Whatever is in season, we are processing. It's me and three other people. We just start work at 7 and finish when we finish, depending on what's in season. Sometimes that's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Sometimes that's 7 o'clock at night. But it's a labor of love, and we love what we do. Everything we put in jars is naturally high acid, so it has a natural low pH. So that kind of sets us apart from Gordy's in the sense that we're not really adding too much to acidify our food. We use verjus and vinegar here and there, but it's mostly strawberries and blueberries that naturally have acid in them. We do fruits in syrup, and we make a lot of hot sauce. which is a lot of fun. It's a process of taking fish peppers, grinding them, salting them, and aging them in beautiful oak barrels from a distillery in Virginia, and then bottling them. And that takes up a lot of our time, but we are now in a new facilities where we have access to fillers and labelers. There's a lot of space. I mean, there's a lot of tinkering.
Can
and
we come?
You're more than welcome to come, yeah. Luckily, two of my guys both are mechanical and electrical, so instead of finding the mechanic that works there to fix the labeler, my guys fix the labeler. So we're really lucky in that sense. I love the people I work with. So, Canning Shed, when I first started, was definitely big. There have a lot of approved products. Spike and the previous people who worked on Canning Shed really went at it and did an amazing job. Since I've been there, we've added a few more approved products on, so now we're up to 52. Wow. But that's just the approved products. We also work with all of the different companies in the Food Shed group, and we do little projects with them throughout the year. They kind of just call us up and say, hey, I'm sending you 100 pounds of something. Can you do something with it? And we say yes. Luckily, we're very versed at being able to take whatever it is and turn it into something else, whether that's adding vinegar, fermenting something, processing something with oil. Our capability and our access within the local food system to create preserves is pretty much endless. And we're really lucky to have that accessibility.
And did you get a bunch of ramps in?
We didn't do ramps this year, but Woodbury did a lot of ramps. Okay. Yeah. And we still have ramps left. We made, I think, about 500 pounds of ramps last year and fermented them. And they're still gorgeous and beautiful and in the refrigerator and under brine, and they look amazing. We did a double fermentation. Or I don't know if you would call it that, but we fermented them with salt first, and then after a few weeks, we added a little vinegar and sugar, and then we pulled them and put them in the fridge. And it's one of my favorite ways to do ramps, just the bottoms, not the tops.
It's always, I mean, ramps are such a fleeting thing, and, you know, one of the first kind of signs that spring is actually on the way, and we're always so happy to see them. This year we got quite a bit. It seemed like a pretty good year for ramps. How did you guys get your stuff to taste so good? I've noticed, like, and one of the great joys about putting this together was to get to taste through a bunch of, Opie got like jars and jars of, and buckets, in your case, buckets and buckets of pickles. And I was just kind of taken all over again with how great Hex Ferments is tasting these days. And I haven't even tasted the kombucha in a while. Maybe that's
Thank
a separate,
you.
Might be a whole separate show. But I told,
because
we could do beverage then. And I told Shane that we had talked about the black Spanish radish, and it's just so damn good.
BSR. Yeah, that's a cult favorite for sure.
I love the dip you made, by the way.
Thanks. That's all Opie. I gotta say, credit where credit's due.
To my heart.
Well, that's a huge compliment, Spike, so thank you. It's taken many years and a lot of trial and error and a lot of kraut that smells like diapers. So we had both kind of grown up with parents that loved to pickle. Whether it would be cucumber quick pickles, whether it be watermelon rind pickles, to the weird stuff my grandmother would pickle, her sauerkraut. So we grew up with that flavor of sour always in our mouths. So when Hex began, it began with just experimentation.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted, you know, like what Sheila was saying, preserve the characteristics of the fruit or vegetable that you're honoring. So for us, it was about finding balance and about, you know, learning pH scales, learning brick scales, teaching ourselves how to cut vegetables in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say, you know, we've been now working with local farms and farmers for about 5-6 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And we really trust our farmer, and we really trust what they grow for us or what they're growing and experimenting with. We don't use any produce that's a second produce. So it's the first harvest. It's going to be the most nutrition packed, the most flavorful. We taste everything. some of our staff are here tonight, and I have to thank them immensely because they're working and learning with us, just as you know, the microbes are working and learning with us. But it's important that we taste everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been a big thing for us in the past year since we've moved out of Belvedere Square Market. If anybody's seen that space, we did 100% of our production there, literally sometimes 24 hours a day. And now that we have literally like elbow room, we're able to move things into the walk-in, get things under control at a much quicker rate than we were able to at Belvedere. So I think that is where we've, in the last year, really started to dial into finding that perfect pH point for a sauerkrauter. Finding out adding star anise to a daikon is going to cut that sulfur. Really being able to experiment and not be afraid to make mistakes.
Right. Because that's such a, I think, and the mistakes you make are not like these catastrophic, like we said, it's going to kill somebody mistake. It's just like, it's a learning mistake.
Tastes bad.
But does it taste bad? Bad?
I mean, not bad, but you know, like over time you might not want to enjoy it as much.
In addition to diaper kraut, there has been.
Is diaper kraut a thing?
Yeah.
It's sort of like when things go south.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
We got diaper kraut, but there's also been puke kraut.
Okay.
Well, let's not get too involved.
Yeah.
But, you know,
especially
like,
right before the meal.
I was just going to say how easy this is to kind of like...
And it's like...
It's really hard to mess it up, but I guess maybe not. I mean,
like, you know, you can go to some pretty dark places with fermentation. But that is also the beauty of it, is that you're working with... you can't see it.
Right.
And so you have to make sure that your checks and balances are correct. And so you're constantly checking things.
And there's little flashlights into this world of, you know, it's like everything's invisible.
Right.
Like short of microscopes and all these, you know, instruments to test things, there's a lot of other things you just can't test for, you know, and a lot of it in the microbiological
realm.
Oh,
today's more humid than yesterday.
Yeah.
Right. And your microbes are doing something else.
Polyphenols and esters and like all these things that combine in weird ways. And like, how did that happen? We did it exactly the same, you know. There's a lot of experimentation.
The weather is a huge factor. I mean, I'm sure you guys have a climate-controlled space, right? But it's still
advertised as.
Exactly. It's working with that season. You know, like as soon as we started bringing in ramps this year, or when we started bringing in local stuff, you could almost feel even the atmosphere in the workspace itself change and shift.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could suddenly feel that damper air that was on the fields. You could suddenly feel it in the space. It's energetically in the vegetable itself. And so when you start washing and cleaning and everybody's working and their elbows are up and everybody's washing and cleaning this plant, the energy is released that way.
Wow. And they're, you know, speaking to local food and why it's important and why do we source from this region versus the sixth largest economy that's California, that's until this year mostly grown in a drought, you know, strangely subsidized through various channels and pegged to the price of oil to be able to be shipped to this far side of the continent. You know, the vegetables suffer in taste, in nutrition, and starting with that quality and honoring all of those relationships
mm-hmm.
that stem from that initial sourcing are vast and deep, and it's nothing to do with fermentation and everything to do with fermentation, you know, it's
a life and a death cycle. Yeah. So you're learning to work with death and you're learning to work with life simultaneously. And so when you're first learning how to ferment, I had a brief conversation with a woman over the amazing pickle spread, and she says, oh, I tried to make vegetable pickles, but it got moldy. And it's like, great. Like, that means it's alive. And I'm glad you got mold, because that means that your water is probably healthy and that there are living things in your environment. we're so tied to antibacterial everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's part of the beauty in the process. We do remove some molds. We do remove calm yeast. It's a daily part of our practice.
Uh-huh.
And you just got to give into it.
Yep.
It's when learning how to say when can be hard. Because at some point, you're like, oh, crap, the kombucha's ready, but we can't bottle it today. So then you risk that next literally like 8, 10, 12 hours of it dipping down just a little bit more sour. And so you got to just jump on things.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Lauren, you came from a culinary background. You were working at a great restaurant in Brooklyn. It's great to hear you guys, Shane and Megan, talk about, you know, the attention they bring to the kraut making. How do you think your work in a restaurant kind of informs what you do at Canning Chip?
Well, I think about what I learned at Franny's every day. And I started there as a host. I mean, I was there front of the house. I learned all of the floor positions. And then I just said, hey, can I come and hang out in your kitchen during the day and then work at night? And they said, of course, free labor, why not? And I was stuck with the really crappy jobs. But besides that, once I did transfer into the kitchen full time, I just always kept my eyes open and my ears open, and I learned from two incredible chefs, and I just tried to mimic everything they did, from physical attributes to the way they saw food and thought about food. And lucky for me, we went to the farmers market 3 times a week. So us being in New York and experiencing those incredible markets was a huge influence for me on how I think about food, just from everyday simplicity of looking at a vegetable and knowing that there's really not too much you have to do to it in order for it to be good. That is the type of produce we work with. That is the type of produce I work with at home. I mean, that's where you start. Like, our jams and jellies, they're not made from crappy second strawberries that have molds on them. Every single thing that goes into our jar, I would dip a handful into the container and eat it. I would never think about putting something into a jar that's moldy in the field. That's a huge misconception in canning.
So you're using the rejects right.
Never. So I'm Franny's, which is where I learned to cook, is a huge part of my life. And every single time I think about moving, I think about learning from Franny's and understanding that a move a little bit too far to the right is actually a waste of your time. There's no point in kind of overdoing something. Everything that you do has a purpose, has a meaning, and that comes from action, but also just the way you think about food and understand food. And simple is better, always. Simple is always better in my mind.
Yeah.
So you mentioned some of the growers that you work with. What are you doing? How do you spend your January and February when there's not a lot going on in the fields?
So we have grower commitment meetings that the company partakes in, where we sit down with our growers and we talk about the past year, the year to come, what's happening on the farm, any changes. I spend a few months of my year going through all historical information, invoices, numbers, pounds, bricks, levels, whatnot, and we bring all of that information to our meetings, and we talk about varieties, new varieties the company wants, quantities. For me, it's very mathematical. I have projections of how many jars of each thing I'm going to be making. But for the company, it's more, oh, we really like that bok choy that you grew last year. Can we have that, but can you make it smaller? So the conversations are luckily, so far, very lighthearted and enjoyable, and it's a time to catch up with our growers because, I mean, without them, we're nothing. Our company is based off of what they do, and they're incredible.
It's a special time of year. It's a lot of fun to catch up.
How many of those, how many of the 52 products you guys, have in the, retail world?
So I would say there's probably 20 or so that are available at the farmers market. I would say there are about 10 of them available at retail stores, but I personally am a big stickler of following the rules. So
we.
So if you're a food manufacturing facilities, if you have that tag, then you are going to be producing things that are approved, period.
Right. Yeah.
Especially like if it's going in a jar and you're processing without approval, like nope, that's right. Not happening. Not under my watch.
Yeah.
So the approvals kind of started there with the possibility of being able to retail them, but unfortunately we have learned over time that sometimes a dried strawberry that's grown locally, that's been cut by hand, that's been dried in a dehydrator, that's not super big, is gonna be a little bit more expensive than your mass-produced manufactured strawberry at the supermarket. So since I've been at the company, we've kind of figured out what it is that we're able to produce and get away with retail-wise, and where we kind of have to like be like, you know what, people aren't gonna spend $10 an ounce on oregano. That's just not really practical.
Yeah.
But with our company, they're gonna use it because this is what they believe in and this is their passion, and we're gonna make it work, and we're here to support our local growers, and this is what we do, period.
So, yeah, the point is that I think that only a few of the things that we've done have we been able to get even remotely close to what people are willing to spend in a supermarket.
Yes.
And then a lot of the other stuff that Lauren does has remained kind of for food shed use because we're kind of willing to pay the premium. And it's, like she said, it's what we do.
And because we do sell it to the company, it has to be approved if it's in a jar to even sell it within the company.
Right.
That's why we do have so many approvals.
Yeah, very few though see the light, kind of the light of the supermarket.
Yeah.
Where are the cucumbers for Gordy's company?
So it just depends on the season. We, unfortunately, because we have, you know, we're shipping to nationwide now, we unfortunately can't work just within, like, the season.
But do you get some locally when...
Oh, yeah. We do, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. It's hard to find exactly, like, you know, we've approached many farmers like Heinz and been like, Heinz, uh-huh. Come on, just grow us all of our cucumbers. And cucumbers are a tough one to grow and to pick because we have specs, so we need to have them like a certain size, and they go from being kind of small to very large in a short period of time, and picking them's really laborious, so it's hard to find small farms that want to do the work.
Right.
So, you know, we two of our favorite farmers, Zach Lester and Heinz, were, you know, just like, give us your field, you know, and they... Not for you, Gomer, something else. So.
Yeah, Heinz is like, he will use a lot of strong language around cucumbers.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
He has a personal hatred of cucumbers.
He does.
What, I mean,
yeah. Anything else, yeah. But not cucumbers. But we've made some really great relationships with, you know, farmers. And but unfortunately, yeah, we do have to source outside of the Mid-Atlantic sometimes.
So Gordy's pickles are going all over the country now? Is that what you're
yeah.
saying?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You told me they're in supermarkets here,
yeah.
Like, was it Harris Teeter?
Harris Teeter, 50 regionally.
That's amazing. So I want to talk to you about this this brine. I mean, I don't know where I first saw it. It might have been Union Market or something. First encountering your brine, your pickle brine, in a can, and I was just like, oh, no, they didn't. Like, it was one of those ideas, like, that was just, like, so cool and so, like,
I remember the day exactly. I think you came up to me and you're like, wow, like, if you could get, you got people to buy a can of your brine instead of drinking their pickle juice out of their fridge.
So where we live in.
I was like, I did it.
So how did that come about?
We religiously drink pickle juice. I mean, we just love it for just energy boosting instead of like a 3 p.m. cup of coffee. If you drink a, you know, half a glass of pickle juice, you're going to replace your electrolytes and you're going to feel like a million bucks. So we were just drinking it all the time in the kitchen. And then we had surplus. We would just, you know, bars would ask us for it. So we started to, like, drop it off at our, you know, with our bartender friends. And, bartenders started ordering it. And we were doing it in, like, 1 gallon or 5 gallon buckets. And I don't know, there was just nothing... like, that felt like sexy about it, or just felt like, I don't know, just, you know, and even with the bars, like they had to figure out ways to use it, you know, put it in something else or whatever. And we were just like, how great would it be to like be in a can? It's transportable, it's convenient, it's, I mean, I'm all about crushing a can of pickle juice. I don't know about you guys.
We're with you.
Yeah, so it just kind of like all made sense to us. So we went for it.
I love it.
Yes.
Well, we have a full house, and I want to, my favorite part of this conversation is when we can kind of open it up, and I think everybody's, all right. So you can certainly ask more questions, but we're going to let these guys ask some questions too.
To Megan, you mentioned high quality Celtic salt that you use. What about the typical canning salt versus what you mentioned, and where do you find it?
She asked about different qualities of salt. So we use a brand specific salt called Celtic sea salt. It's a hand harvested, hand dried, air dried sea salt. So it's just the seawater, dehydrated, evaporated by nature. It contains all 32 minerals to support life. Versus say like, are you talking like a kosher salt? So kosher salt is the salt that's, it's been stripped away. So when you have like table salt or iodized salt, it's sodium chloride with all the other minerals gone, and then they add back iodine as a nutritional supplement. We don't use those salts. A lot of those salts contain chemicals, anti-caking agents. We don't need iodine added back in. It actually discolors vegetables. So that's the salt we use.
Where do you get the Celtic salt?
Well, we get it through the supplier itself, but you can buy it at Whole Foods or Mom's, any market that even has.
And you
like
use
a
this because it you believe it helps your ferments?
We believe it helps. We like the extra nutritional power that it lends to it. So when you ferment anything, you're essentially breaking down the ingredients to make them bioavailable. So when you use a higher quality salt, you get all those minerals, electrolyte possibilities that happen through more expansive fermentation process. Yeah.
So to follow up with that,
one
of the past one of these we had, the folks from Dickinson Salt out in West Virginia.
Yeah.
So what's different from like the sea salt versus salt that's coming from West Virginia?
Well, they're digging from an old ocean bed. So it's just a different resource.
A different mineral balance, basically, based on the environment from which they're harvesting, but very similar in it. You know, I mean, again,
there's books written on salt. There's nations built on salt.
Sodium,
it's a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Sodium chloride, the one thing that is like the sharp, tasty maker that's the refined salt versus sodium chloride found in its natural environment with the minerality from whence it came. It's a whole other flavor, really. It's like, you don't have the sodium chloride bite. You have this breadth of flavor that comes from everything else.
Yeah.
How much salt do you guys use?
I mean, relative to our ferments.
To the ferments, you know,
2%,
we're ordering 55 pound bags.
That's not
You know.
Yeah.
Every here and there, and we use actually two different kinds. We use a what's called a white kosher chef salt. So it's a little bit finer, but it's slightly processed, so we use it for dry brining, for doing kimchi. Just kind of, it breaks down a little bit faster. Plus, we're kind of getting rid of that salt, so we don't want to use a super high quality salt and then get rid of half of it. We want to kind of be a little bit, bit conscious of that. Salt is a wonderful thing. There's a, you know, the great Salt Lakes of Utah, there's a company out there called Real Salt. Their salt's finer, and they also do a rougher salt. It's going to contain different vitamins and minerals. You can ferment with any kind of salt. Just don't use salt with silica added or any other, like, caking or whatever that caking agent is.
Great. Well, it's so nice to hear from all of you. Thank you. I was intrigued by something that both of you from Hex Ferment said, that sort of it's trial and error and sort of mysterious how things happen. So how do you check, like how often do you check on your products? And
every day.
Okay, and then what are you looking for?
Flavor. I'm just the flavor. Flavor, pH balance, crunchiness, brininess.
So
it's, yeah.
Yeah, depending, I mean, like, for example, cabbage, you know, we're able to source it all year round.
Locally.
But the cabbage that we get that is in January, February is all storage cabbage. So it's been sitting, the sugars have been concentrating, it's lost some moisture. We have to treat that differently. Mm-hmm. And just as an aside, this is so much different than industrial food. You know, it's just a very different process. So we adapt the way that we cut it, you know, sometimes to the half millimeter, to know how it will translate into the jar with the mouthfeel to derive the right amount of brine. And sometimes that ferments at a different rate than, you know, a little bit earlier cabbage with more water content type of thing. And depending on what we're also adding, you know, for example, we have other kinds of sauerkrauts that don't have just cabbage, but other ingredients, and then that same calculation is happening depending on, you know, if we have a big old carrot versus, you know, like dry but delicious garlic, you know, that type of balance.
So I grew up as a missionary kid in Korea. This is ages 6 to 16, from like 1960 to 1970. So I ate a lot of kimchi.
Lucky.
And what I would assume would be the original Korean kimchi. So could you all that know something about it, it's turned into sort of an international culinary concept now. So what is the original Korean kimchi, if I can call it that, and how have things changed?
That's a deep
don't even know what the original sauerkraut is. I mean, I think it's kimchi is such a specific food to the Korean culture, and when we set out to make kimchi, we wanted to make a kimchi in honor and in light of that tradition. So when we started doing research and talking to people and tasting kimchis, from kimchis you get up at H Mart to Sue's kimchi to the kimchi that Sander made, we started to realize that kimchi is not just one thing. And even Koreans will say there's as many kimchis on the planet as there are people. And so I think it's really a family-specific thing when you come down to it, which with all of this food, that is its heritage, that is its origin, is that it comes from the home. So when we set out to make our kimchi, we wanted it to be a little bit from our home, as well as in honor of that Korean mainstay that people get dividends for at the end of a year's work to go and buy ingredients for their kimchi. Like, think about our society, how happy we would be if we all got a dividend to go make sauerkraut or a pickle. We'd be so happy. Like when you go eat Korean barbecue, right? You're so happy.
Thank you. Great presentations by everybody. You're begging a really interesting question, because normally when people go into the food business, they're either building on existing tastes or they're making a market. You guys seem more popular than Georgetown cupcakes. So the question is, could each of you talk about what you think is inherent in the human taste that wants and really craves the taste of fermenting and brining that you offer? Why not sweet? Why is it going in your direction?
I think everyone wants a little bit of balance. And I think that acidified salty, briny foods help keep everything really balanced in any dish.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it's universal and something that has existed well before all of us, you know.
Yeah.
Pickling dates back to 1000 BC, and it's inherent in all cultures.
I mean, sour is power.
I think it's a real travesty that flavor is not more prominent, along with a host of other flavors, you know, including bitter, that have been sort of outshined by salty, crunchy, fat, you know, pushed on us by, or pushed on much of Western society by large industrial food makers. Not to sound like that guy.
You can sound like that guy.
Yeah. But for real, like, you know, there's a lot of flavor there, and like sour is just inherent in like the spectrum of the human palate.
I love it when we're at a farmer's market or we're at a store or one of our staff comes back from a tasting, and it's always the little girl or the little boy, and the mom and dad say to them, "Oh, you won't like that because it's sour." And then the little girl, the little boy,
they love it.
Their little nose knows, and they're so adamant for that taste.
Uh-huh.
And then the mom or dad is like, "You like that?" And it's like this whole world opens up to that kid's palate. They're like, "Whoa, this tastes really good." And I think that's just what it is that people want a different taste. And we've kind of been denied for a little while, I think, of some of that breath of sour, and not just it being, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong, like a pickle is great. I think I ate like 6 of those spears out there tonight alone. But I also want to taste like a fermented radish or a really good hot sauce that's been fermented. And it's the breadth of flavors that pickling and fermentation create that I think is what's getting people so excited.
Have you worked with any food scientists? If you talk to the people at Nornell up in Philadelphia, or people in Orlando University, you will find that there's some very interesting human research on salty and sour that would actually help what you're doing, understanding it, why people crave it.
I would be fascinated. Yeah. I mean, I know, like, well, for instance, like when people come to us, they come to us for one or two reasons. One is health, and the other is they heard about us somewhere and they're curious. Or they're just a customer. And for people that it's health, they've never had anything sour before. And so they're reintroducing sour for the first time into their diet. And either they're going to be like a kombucha person or they're going to be like a kraut person. And typically I find that they're kombucha people because it's sweet and it's sour. And then suddenly they start getting intrigued by a pickle, or they know of pickles, or they know of sauerkraut. And I think that palate, your body actually starts to crave it. And that's why you have companies like Lay's Potato Chips making, you know, they've made dill, you know, vinegar and salt, but now they're making kimchi potato chips. They're making all these umami flavors that were not very prominently present in industrialized Western diets. But yeah, I'd love to know those names.
We'll talk.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts about that? Good. All right.
They covered it all.
All right. They covered it. I'll say.
You didn't really talk much or at all about kombucha. And I moved here a couple years ago from California, and I had friends who made kombucha. And I moved here and thought, oh, I'm going to make kombucha. And stuff online scared the hell out of me. I mean, if I make my own, is it going to kill me?
No.
What's the...
You'll be fine.
What's the kombucha science?
I think a lot of people here make kombucha that can probably talk about it.
Yeah, in general, this is a sentiment that are confronted with often is like food fear. And as Spike mentioned, you know, fermented vegetables are the safest, like zero reported foodborne illness from fermented vegetables. I mean, contrast that with spinach or melons or something. You could take those same listeria-laden melons and ferment them, and they would be safe to eat. And that happens around the world as well, as foods that are detoxified through fermentation. But food fears, so often it's just like get to know the process and it becomes familiar. But Megan is the kombucha queen.
Queen.
Yeah.
I don't know about that.
The amount of bottles we have in our kitchen. Oh my God.
Kombucha is a totally safe beverage to make. It's been made for thousands of years, very safely. Again, like that little girl, that little boy who's trying to pickle the nose knows. And so if you're making anything that's fermented or pickled, like you open it up, this doesn't smell right. Well, maybe come back in a couple more days. Or maybe it just really doesn't smell right and you should pitch it. But kombucha, there's a lot of books out there that tell you how to make kombucha. I wouldn't go to the internet for kombucha. There seems to be a lot of, like, fear.
There's a lot of fear.
It's really interesting. Yeah, it's like... I field probably about 6 calls a week, believe it or not, on people calling me. And I've gotten calls from all over the United States. I read on the internet. And I go, okay, what did you read on the internet? That you were not supposed to add honey to kombucha. And I said, well, that's just wrong. So there's a lot of talk about quality of honey. But really, I mean, it's a fermentation process using a culture to create a specific outcome. So when you add a kombucha SCOBY to sweetened cooled tea, you have to know a little bit about balance, but you also just have to know a little bit about patience and waiting for it to develop acidity and flavor.
Or you could just buy it.
Or you could just do it that way. Or you could buy a kombucha SCOBY and you could just call me on the phone and ask me how to make it.
Just don't ask her if there's honey's okay in it.
But I think that opens up an interesting conversation, though, too. It's just that you shouldn't believe everything that you read on the internet.
No. And, any category.
Whether it's like canning and, you know, the whole B word or, you know, like...
what's the B word?
Botulism.
Oh.
You know, like, let's think about this for a second here. Like, people have been doing this for a pretty long time now, and we've got a lot of the kinks worked out, so let's just trust our own kitchen instincts instead of maybe the internet's kitchen.
Or big, huge corporations' instincts, which I think is part of that. It's part of the reason I think we're so disconnected from this stuff, is that they, you know, it serves them for us to feel like we don't know how to do this, or that it's dangerous, or whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
Now I'm being that guy.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you buy what, thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds of local organic produce every year. Yeah, you are that guy. You know, like, and you should probably be that guy, because like. Not to get off topic, but that's what we have found so inspirational of Woodbury Kitchen and your endeavors and what you guys do is like, whoa, Woodbury Kitchen put millions of dollars back into the local food system this year. Like, that's incredible. And because of, you know, the fruits of all of our labors buying local produce, we have seen our farmers grow a lot over the past few years. And I think that the more we are that guy, the better off all of our guts are going to be.
While we're there, it's worth reinforcing that sentiment that you've basically created an umbrella for us to exist in a way that I don't think would have happened in the way that it has, especially for our business, without Woodbury Kitchen and your efforts. So.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate that. And this is one of, we talked about this, but this is one of the first places you guys sold your kombucha, right?
It is.
To like pile on, but that was that was a big moment. I love that.
Speaking of origins, our first farmer's market was out back.
Yes. Awesome.
At Union Grace.
Right. Yeah. Do you guys still do that?
Are we doing that? Yes, we do. But we do 6 of them or so, right?
We do. It's like a local food happy hour with live music and stuff. So we found people wanted to less grocery shop and more just like enjoy enjoy a local treat or snack or like
graze.
Yeah.
Graze.
So we still do it, awesome. But with like things you can eat now instead of things you can cook later.
Right. Cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I love the primitiveness of what you're doing. I love the fact that you're all modern day alchemists. And I'm trying to understand better the health aspects of fermented foods, because you read a lot that that our diet has become too acidic, that we need to be moving more towards alkaline foods. So can you speak a little bit more towards the health aspects of fermentation?
Well, so fermented foods and these pHs are considered alkaline.
Similar to how when, if you ate a lime, you know, despite it being acidic, the way your body sees it, it alkalizes. But that's like a one...
That's only one facet of it. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
For most people, the entry into live food, for us, our live food offerings are... you know, kimchi, sauerkraut, pickles, kombucha, but in the larger realm of live foods, so real yogurt, dairy and water kefirs, that type of thing.
They're all probiotics. You hear the word probiotic, it just means bacteria. All bacteria are bacteria. There's no good bacteria and there's no bad bacteria. So what we do is we create a living food that has rich and beneficial bacteria that are good for your gut. Some of the ingredients that we use are specifically geared maybe towards certain medicinal herbal qualities, so we throw that in there every once in a while to aid in the benefit of either gut healing or stress reduction. Maybe we want to add a little bit more prebiotic fiber to things, so adding onions and garlic, ginger, and things like that.
And then sort of the larger health and science movement right now is centered around the microbiome, the totality of the invisible microbes that make us us. And, you know, we're big believers that a lot of degenerative disease, you know, apart from antibiotics and the environment, comes from dead food. And so trying to get more people to eat live food to enrich and diversify their inner ecosystem will help inform. Is that I'm rambling?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
Well, I just, there's nutritive aspects too in non-fermented foods, like what Lauren is making even with jams and things like that. So,
and I think we're definitely touching on the fact that we're using food that's coming from a few miles away versus a few hundred thousand miles away. So your food is being picked when it's ripe. It's high in nutrients. It has natural sugars and carbohydrates. The vitamins are just as high.
Yeah.
You know, they're as high as they can be, instead of food that has every single, like, I think it's daily you lose 20% of vitamins based off of travel distance. There's tons of data on it, and the sooner you are consuming the food off the vine, it's more nutritious for you, and it's definitely going to impact the way a fermented or a canned food is going to taste and the way it is going to influence your system.
And how about how happy you are when you just eat a good tasting pickle?
Yeah,
there's,
very happy.
There's got to
exactly.
be, a, yeah.
Just,
I
just
think that's
a,
that's
got
to be a part. I think it's better to eat a pickle. I think a pickle as a snack, too, is a better deal than a lot of other, like,
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yes. Do you use any of the brines when you brine chicken or anything at the restaurant?
We've been messing around with that. We've been brining like trout lately with not with the Gordy's, with her brine.
Okay. Because Nina loves the Mael Cornichons, and when she's done with the pickles, I put the brine in my chicken brine.
Yeah.
And it's the best.
So I've heard about quick pickles and pickles with heat. Can you talk a little bit about the difference in quick pickling and the type of pickling you do, and why you would do one, choose one over the other?
That's a good question.
Well, I mean, it's so either is safe, but if we're talking about how did you say it was food, people are, food fears?
Food fear.
Okay, if you have food fears and you're scared of maybe canning, because you're worried about botulism, quick pickling would be a sure bet to achieve the same result, but I would also encourage everyone not to be afraid to can any of the local produce that you're finding at farmers markets at home. The USDA has a great book that you can buy online. I think it's like $7. All of the recipes are pre-approved, and it just comes down to time and temperatures, and it's boiling, you know, in water baths, whatever pickles you're making.
Yeah, I think also, like, you know, if you're buying ramps now and you want to eat them in the winter, like, canning is the way to go. If you, you know, just want to pickle ramps for your meal or whatever it is, quick pickling's great. So.
Does, when you heat it, does that impact the crunchiness? Is that, you know,
It can if you don't do it correctly. So there's definitely, like, a certain temperature you need. Time and temperature are everything when you're putting it in a can. So if you go 5 degrees over the temperature, the perfect temperature, then you're gonna get not a crunchy pickle. So there's definitely a secret to the time and temperature.
And also the window that the vegetable was picked is really important. Okay. You don't wanna can anything that was picked less than 24 hours. So, just not working.
For the ideal.
Yeah, for your ideal shelf-stable canned pickle. So maybe in that case, if it was a few days old, you might want to just quick pickle it.
That's worth mentioning. There are some things that are much better canned than they are fermented.
Exactly,
Tomatoes. They're terrible. I mean, we've tried all kinds of experiments, but largely terrible fermented. I've made, like, those things.
It can go really
those things that shall not be named.
For instance, like canning, when you can tomatoes, you actually have a higher lycopene content that you use sometimes with fresh tomatoes, which I think is really interesting. So yeah, I mean, canned tomatoes.
Right. Yeah. And the distinction, I think, to the question is, if you're quick pickling, you like the taste of something that's sour and acidic that's been pickled, but something that's in a jar is like a true preservation method that you're actually going to, you want to keep around for 6 months or a year.
Right.
Yeah.
And we quick pickle it at Woodbury, you know, like in the restaurant because we want that flavor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The pickles that, well, we don't do any thermally processed pickles, but the Gordy's pickle that sits on a shelf is going to sit there and can sit there and be a very high quality thing for a year or longer.
Right.
And that's the difference for me is like quick pickling is nice. It's tasty. But this, where the preservation thing becomes meaningful, I think is why you thermally process and get it on the shelf, make it shelf stable.
What is your shelf?
One more.
At the expense of embarrassing anyone here, I happen to be a food scientist.
I happen to be a food scientist, and I live on both sides of the spectrum. But I have to say that the fermented foods, we're only on the spectrum of understanding what's going on with the microbiome. And there's a lot of metabolites that go through fermentation that are really, really healthy. And we need to incorporate that into our diet, especially for people who are used to eating food that is further processed and salted and sugared. And you talked about Monel. We do a lot of work with Monel. There's a lot of science behind it. And I do think that there is a lot of benefit to what you're all doing from both the fresh off the vine local. There's a lot of nutrients in those materials. You don't get that through the industrial side of food. So I commend you for what you're doing. I commend you for working within your local areas. And I think the food industry is trying to understand what we've done and what we need to do moving in the future. But it's really coming from the folks who are paying attention to these details. And I thank you for that, because it's really changing the food industry from what it was, which was all about supply chain, to what it should become, which is more about what we really should be eating and not eating.
Great.
That's good. I think that's a good place to end.
That could be. I've really loved this talk, and the great news for everybody here is that we get to continue over supper. Tonight it is prominently featuring some fermented and pickled ingredients, including a kind of a riff on a kimchi stew that Opie and his team have put together. We also have just some straight up fresh asparagus because, hey, it's May.
Why and, not?
Yeah, right? Exactly. And I want to thank this amazing group that's come together tonight. You guys inspire us.
Thanks again for joining us tonight for our conversation at Artifact Coffee. With special thanks to Dana Slater for producing the program, Hannah Reagan for her masterful coordination, and particular thanks to Donnie Carlo for recording this evening's conversation. We're grateful to be partnering with Heritage Radio in Brooklyn, New York. Thank you to them for creating a home for the Origin Speaker Series.